Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. This is episode 197. How are you all doing, guys? Thank you for tuning in. I've got two great guests this week. Last week, in fact, this week's podcast was recorded on the same day as last week's podcast. And last week's was particularly popular. We've had a lot of feedback. We did top five songs that make you cry with Chris and Stu of the Hardcore Listing podcast. If you haven't checked that out, go and check it out and then check out the Hardcore Listing podcast. But yeah, it was a particularly popular one and you've been flooding our timelines with your top five songs that make you cry and with annoyance at the fact that we were in tears throughout the podcast, putting a lot of you in tears. So sorry about that. But this week's guests are amazing. It's Alan Hughes and Jimmy Iovine, and these are two of the people I've been most excited to talk about. As a lot of you will know, I turn down a lot of press junket type runs because you normally get 5 or 10 minutes and I normally need an hour. But with this one, they put forward the idea to have half hour with each of these guys, and they're icons, man. Their documentary, The Defiant Ones, is on Netflix now, and it's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen in my life. You'll hear in the first part, I've put them all in this podcast, but it's two parts in one podcast. You'll hear, as I'm talking to Alan Hughes, that I was blown away by the direction of the documentary, the way it was put together, the way it looked, the way it sounded, the way it emoted all the stories told. So, yeah, it was great. And then in the next part, I talked to Jimmy Iovine, which is all, again, you don't need to download two things. I've put them all here together. In the next part was Jimmy Iovine. And if you don't know, Jimmy, as you'll see in the documentary, The Defiant Ones on Netflix, Jimmy, in unusual circumstances, ended up working on a John Lennon record. And then he worked on Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run, and Patti Smith, Easter, and Tom Petty albums and singles and all sorts of craziness. And then he started a little record label, which also spawned Death Row Records. And he signed Dre and Snoop and Tupac. And he signed Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson and No Doubt. And just so many people, Lady Gaga, all sorts of stuff. And then he started Beats with Dre. So yeah, he's got a hell of a story and he's a hell of an experience. Speaking of record labels, this podcast is brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's my record label. I've not got Snoop and Dre and Tupac, but I have got Sage Francis and B. Dolan and POS and War and Peace and Giacomo Brown and my good self, Scroobius Pip, and Polar Bear, and Rob Alton, and loads of amazing people. Have I left anyone off? I hope I've not left anyone off. And also a load of merch, a load of podcast merch. So yeah, head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com to do that and support the podcast. There's loads of good stuff over there. But equally, as said, go and watch The Defiant Ones on Netflix. That's free. That's literally there if you've got your Netflix subscription. And it's fantastic. It really is. I got a preview link to watch them all, and I sat there just open-jawed, amazed at the lives. It's about Jimmy Iovine and Dre and their parallel lives and how it came together. But yeah, it's amazing. So, first of all now, I'm going to let you hear me chat with Alan Hughes. And as you'll hear, I was quite excited. He's someone that I really rate as a director. He did Menace to Society, man, him and his brother. And Menace is one of my favourite films. He did Dead Presidents and From Hell and loads of stuff that I really rate. So it was exciting to talk to Alan. I was pleased. I like it when we do these press junkets because the reason I don't often do them is, as said, you get these 10-minute slots. And I kind of prefer to get really in depth on things and nerd out and be excited. As anyone who listens will know, I get excited on these podcasts. And that often doesn't quite fit into a press junket. But what I found particularly with Alan was that it's nice for those guys as well sometimes, because they're often talking to 20 journalists. Some of them have watched the thing, some of them haven't. They've got 10 minutes, so they're not really going in depth on anything. And me and Alan really hit it off. Yeah, I'll let you hear that and then I'll pop back in a minute. Enjoy. Alan Hughes.
Good, how you doing?
Good to meet you.
Let me get some water.
Some water.
Take some water. That's the word that people never understand me saying in America. Particularly from Essex. Water. They're like, what?
Yeah, I did a Jack the Ripper film years ago, and I had some a fun British cast, and they were dummy down.
Or Johnny Depp loves nothing more than an exaggerated British accent, right? So it's perfect.
Oh wow, look at this setup. Did Jimmy already come in or am I first?
You're first. Okay, you're leading
I'm his fluffer today.
Yeah, that's perfect.
So I should sit up on this microphone.
Yeah, it's all good. Or whatever's comfortable, man. I've got them kind of they're all recording decent now.
Tipping now like this.
That's how it's gotta be. I do these I've started recording in the traditional podcast manner of it just being casual,
loose and free.
I had someone.
How long is this?
It's 30 minutes.
We're 30 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
so we got some relaxed time. Then.
Yeah, I had someone tweet me the other day about my interviews, and I had to explain I don't do interviews, I have conversations. So that's what we're here to do. It's not this formal thing, it's just us having a chat. So.
You know what? That was the magic of this film for me, is that people were like, how did you interview? I'm like, and I just learned it when I was finished with the film. I go, man, the best interviews were conversations.
Yeah, and you've got people who aren't going to be afraid to talk either. Obviously, I should say I'm here with Alan Hughes, and we're here to talk about the amazing The Defiant Ones, a documentary series I absolutely loved. And yeah, exactly that. When you've got Snoop, again, anyone who follows him on social media knows he doesn't need another person to have a conversation.
No.
He can do that himself. So then when you've got Springsteen, you've got Tom Petty, all these people have got these amazing stories. I think the greatest realisation, and it's something that struck me hugely in your style of documentary making, was to remove yourself from it completely.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Just really sit back, and then where you put yourself into it was the way it played out, because it played out like, it's going to sound odd, but it felt like a DJ playing a set in a club.
100%.
It had mixed from rock to rap seamlessly. And even if it's interviews, you'd have the ramping up of the set and the drop off of the set and things like that. And I'd not seen that in a documentary particularly before, that it felt like a DJ rather than a
very keen a because absolutely the one, there's I was naive about a lot of things going into the film.
Yeah.
But the one thing I said to myself, I go, I'm going to make this the way Dre used to make records.
Yeah.
The way Dr. Dre used to make those early NWA records. He approached it like a DJ.
Yeah.
And a lot of those early records that he made, there were like, so obviously there's the verses and the hooks, but then he would have that bridge into a whole other subset of the song I can't even describe.
Yeah.
And I took a cue from that and record producers, Jimmy being a record producer, but more hip-hop because hip-hop adopts and swallows up everything in its path, you know, genres. So I knew that going in.
Yeah.
I didn't know it would be effective, though.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It worked, man. Yeah. So, I mean, as we've got half an hour, I'm excited to... Obviously, we're going to talk a lot about the Defiant Ones, but I can rewind a little bit and go into things. So, born in Detroit and then growing up in LA, directing films, that's not a path that's often openly pushed as a viable option. So where did you and your brother obviously kind of get that motivation and decide that that's what you wanted to do? Well, what drove you in that?
In the Midwest, in Detroit, when you come up, you know, Hollywood has this allure that's even greater than when you're from, obviously, somewhere closer to it, or New York or Chicago. Chicago is more like, it is the Midwest, so what am I talking about?
Yeah.
But Chicago is a big city.
Yeah, of course.
A big media city. So Detroit, at the time, was disintegrating and decomposing.
Yeah.
And the West always had this allure, you know, and the music was out there. So we were twins, and we always thought we were going to be in front of the camera.
Right.
But these noses and our lack of talent in front of the camera. But we moved out West thinking that we would be in commercials and film. And I don't
know. How was it to get out there and see? Because the thing that I had when I the first time, because I used to do a music, and the first time I toured America and hit LA, and it was hip hop, and I kind of get out there and I'm like, this place is a shithole, and I didn't like that at first. It took a few visits to make me realize, hang on, I come from shitholes. I'm most comfortable in shitholes. So as soon as I dropped that perception of Hollywood being this shiny thing, I was like, the roughness of it was what I loved about LA.
Yeah.
And that was the beauty of it. So coming from somewhere like Detroit, which it's not for me to describe as a shithole at the time, but it was known as a rough, rundown area, you know?
Yeah.
So to get to LA and it not be this shiny Hollywood, was that kind of motivational in a way to go, oh, right, this Mecca is just what I'm familiar with. It's just I wasn't here. We were looking at it from across the country.
It's interesting. I learned that later.
Yeah.
Not when we got there, because we were outside of LA, but you're absolutely right that it could be pretty shitty.
Yeah.
You know, I think once we got to Los Angeles County, it was close there, the dream, you know. Yeah. And as kids, we were making, you know, it was the advent of the home video camera and home video stores. And, and we just started, most kids, if they had gotten their hands on a video camera, they were making skate videos or BMX bike videos or whatever. Yeah. Or stupid shit like jumping off roofs into a swimming pool, whatever hell it was. And we just started making movies from moment one.
Amazing.
Not because we came here with that dream.
Yeah.
You know, we came here. We came to Los Angeles with that dream. But you don't know. Like, I think the interesting thing about being in a major media market is you get major media market competition.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
even
yeah,
in high school.
Yeah.
You know, so people's aspirations are more intense when they're close to it. And so that started forging us like a diamond, you know, because
it raises you. Your level, man. If everyone else around you is at a level, you're like, oh, well, shit, we came here to be the best. We got
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
They had public access cable at the time as well. That came on the scene when I was in high school.
Yeah.
So I had five shows on public access at the same time. I had a talk show. I had a variety show. I had a feature I would do every week. And so the public is seeing it. Again, you're right in a major media market, so your stuff is on public access, but it's right next to all the major stuff as well.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's amazing. So in the documentary, it obviously it goes through the time of NWA and things like that. When I was touring a lot, I'd get back, and there was a cinema in London called the Prince Charles Cinema, and it's one of the oldest cinemas, and they allowed me to program a series of films over a number of months, and I chose films I'd fallen in love with on DVD or video, but not seen in the cinema. And one of the things I screened was A Menace to Society, because it was just a film that I adored and loved, and watching it on the big screen, it's that weird thing of when I was programming these things, I was like, a few of these films I've not watched in a while, are they going to have aged? And it hadn't at all. It felt like it could come out, you know, a year ago. And so how was that as kind of in the film you have, obviously in 91 there was the Rodney King beating that kind of spawned NWA and then the LA riots, but only a few years later you and your brother were documenting that in Menace to Society and telling these stories. So so what drove you to know that was the story that you had to tell and the style that you were going to come out with?
Yeah. Well, in the 80s, first off, all that stuff was going down in the inner cities with the black youth.
Yeah.
As far as gang violence and crack.
Yeah.
Was at an all-time high in 88 when I was in high school. And it was spilling over into the suburbs as far as police and the way police were policing.
Yeah.
And so we were interested in going with Menace, like, how did that kid get that way? The kid you see on Cops. Or the kids you see in the news running from the helicopter.
Completely.
What's his story, you know? Yeah. So we had developed the story early on when in high school. And then this language we started learning, this lexicon of like real film and how you approach shooting real film. I brought a lot of that to the Defiant Ones as well.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I loved about The Godfather, you can't talk about The Godfather enough to me, because Francis's approach to it was classic.
Yeah.
So it stands the test of time. The way it was framed, it was no zooms that were heavy in the 70s in that film. The production design, the acting, the writing was all timeless.
Yeah.
So we approached, although Menace has aged in a few other ways, the approach was very much from the old school cinema.
Yeah.
So that's what we brought to it because we were new to it. We were new to we were fast because in high school we were doing comedic things.
Yeah.
And then as out of high school and the film school, we learned the power of which got your hands on Super 8 and 16 millimeter.
Yeah.
Oh, this is serious. We get to do it properly. Actually, it's easier to do drama than it is comedy.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people know that. So that stuff was going on at the time in the culture and the communities, the black communities. And what wasn't going on in black cinema at that time was bringing cinema to it.
Yeah.
You know, that visceral nature.
100%.
And, you know, I know we've over the years had some words about Boys in the Hood. But ultimately, it's like that was more I just thought we could do better.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating one.
Talk some shit now.
No, no, that's it. Because there's so much talk now, and rightfully so, of this resurgence of black cinema with Moonlight, with Black Panther. Yet, growing up, it was about Menace, Boys in the Hood, Do the Right Thing, all these great films. And it's weird that there was this gap. Because, again, it's similar with the resurgence, like with people talking of Wonder Woman, of being a powerful thing about women. At that same time, in the 80s and the late 80s and 90s, there was a Ridley Scott doing Alien with powerful women and Terminator with powerful female leads. So
James Cameron always had powerful female leads.
Yeah, it's just strange how there was suddenly all the things that are being praised now. It's like, well, that was happening in the 80s and 90s, and then it just stopped for some reason. So it's kind of a weird thing, right? The cinema took that dip and has come back round. But is it exciting for you to see this return of as I said, black cinema that's got the drama, that's got the cinema in it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very exciting because it's so disparate. The like you say, Moonlight.
Yeah.
You know, to Black Panther, they couldn't be more different.
Completely.
12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
You know, to whatever Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
I think it's important though because the knee jerk is from the Oscar So White thing of a couple years ago. Everyone gets political. Let's make sure that these motherfuckers have their films, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at first, it's the quality isn't there in every film. A lot of the films do have quality, but I think the competition now, that's what black cinema has to start focusing on is let's make each other better. Let's not just be here because of politics.
Completely. Yeah. There's something that I've brought up too many times on this podcast, but I think it's relevant to bring up with you here. It blows my mind that no one's made a great dramatic film about the LA riots. There's some amazing documentaries about it, but the stories in there of what happened with the Asian community and the black community and the police and everything else, it blows my mind that no one seems to have told that story yet. And now we're at a point where there are writers and the directors are like yourself and many others who literally lived through that, but now have the ability to tell these stories. So I'm hopeful for
a Netflix series or
something. Because previously it would have been, with the greatest respect, sitting here as a white man, it would have been a white person writing what they feel is a fair depiction of what happened to the black community. It
would have been Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Remember that film?
Yeah.
It would have been a fable.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas now there's so many people who are winning Oscars and Grammys and awards who lived through that. And there's such a, like, I've watched, there's great documentaries about it and books about it. But I think there's a certain thing in drama. And Netflix is changing it. But a few years back, a certain kind of person would watch a documentary, another kind of person would watch a drama. Now, Netflix have changed that with Making a Murderer, and now the Defiant Ones on there and things like that. But it's still a case, I think, that you can do a certain amount with documentaries and a different amount with drama. So what gave you the confidence in making this documentary? Because, damn, it's a hell of a subject to cover. With Jimmy's life alone, but Dre as well, it's spanning from Lennon, Springsteen, Patti Smith, all the way up to or along Snoop and Tupac and Biggie and Dre and Beats and everything else. So what what made you think that this was the story to tell? And how did you even get your head round?
I was arrogant enough to think I knew what to do.
Yeah.
You know, I was arrogant enough to think it was, I didn't think, ultimately the Defiant Ones that is out and people will be seeing is much greater than what I had in my head, you know.
Right.
Because I didn't know all those stories, especially on the Jimmy side. I didn't know all those stories.
Yeah.
Stevie Nicks, Tom Petty, on top of all those you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And all the interconnectivity of it to U2 and the start of Interscope and how Jimmy first heard The Chronic for the first time. Jimmy hadn't heard a hip-hop record from beginning to end before The Chronic. He was not a hip-hop guy.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what's so, again, there's so many mind-blowing bits in there. And Dre first hearing Eminem through Jimmy and that kind of thing. You're watching that like, God damn, this is insane.
It's, you know, but you don't know. You know, you go in, you have the... you have your little roadmap, and along the way, there's all these detours that are far more fascinating than what the original plan was.
Yeah.
And so the film that people are seeing now, The Defiant Ones, is just me being open to it, you know, and to your point earlier, having a conversation.
Yeah.
And I said, fuck an interview. Let's have a conversation.
Yeah, you know? Completely.
And the people really opened up because they still, the subjects... A lot of those people that sat down, these rock stars, still have a great relationship with Jimmy and Dre, have a lot of love for them.
Yeah.
And it made it that much easier. And then my approach, similar to your approach, was to have that conversation. And I hadn't thought about it. Most of these people I'm sitting down with are some of the greatest poets, writers of all time.
Completely.
So that conversation, just off the charts, the narrative. Yeah. And they're also great listeners.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating. You know? Yeah. I thought, you know, I mean... Snoop Dogg is one of the greatest listeners I've ever
had
been around.
Yeah.
And he just listens and listens, and he's always building.
Yeah.
So then he adds, and then you get his, you know, just incredible because he's just very present. A lot of them are very present. You know?
Did you know or already have relationships with a lot of those guys?
Yeah.
Because again, with Menace and Dead Presidents and things like that, they were key at that time when rap was blowing up. So I guess you were part of that. That world of what was being told.
Yeah, I mean, go back.
So did that help?
You look at Tupac. I mean, Eazy-E was my first. I hate to use the word mentor.
Yeah.
I'm very close to Eazy. My brother and I did all of Tupac's first music videos, and we're very close to Tupac. And Snoop, I met at the Menace to Society premiere in the bathroom, pissing, you know, and
amazing.
He's trying to convince, you know, talk me into putting him into a film. And I was always friendly with Snoop. He eventually moved out to my city, and he was a neighbor. But at the time, you talk about that time in cinema and in hip-hop where it was all overlapping and soundtracks are big.
Yeah.
So when I would go to New York, L.A., the Bay Area, this before Southern rap got big, you know.
Yeah.
And everyone knew each other.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 45 years old. Snoop is 45, 46, you know.
Yeah.
Andre 3000 is 45, 46.
Yeah.
If Tupac was alive and Biggie, there would be 45. It was all one class
at the time, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, what you were saying earlier about the way The Godfather was shot jumps out to me as why, even if you didn't, if you did or didn't have the confidence, why you would work as a documentary maker. Because the way The Godfather was shot and the way Menace was then shot was, it was as if you were documenting a reality. It wasn't about these fast zooms and pans to make it. It was having the cinematicness, but it was allowing it to move within the frame, allowing it to play out, which, if it wasn't for the fact that these are actors saying these lines, that's how documentaries work. You're just the documenting the thing that's going on in front of you. So did you find as you started making it, you were like, oh, shit, I know how to do this. I know how this works.
You know, I had an epiphany actually recently about the process of why Menace worked.
Yeah.
Because 50% of it was improvised, one.
Yeah.
And a lot of those guys hadn't acted before, two. And three, to your point, it was one half documentary, just the approach to it. I didn't know that till I got on this thing.
Yeah.
Even though I had done a documentary with my brother called American Pimp in 99, it wasn't until I did the Defiant Ones where I went, oh, shit, this is what was so special about Menace. The urgency.
Yeah.
And the immediacy and the realness of doing a documentary. So I can't wait to do my next feature film.
Yeah.
To to bring. That's what I loved about the Defiant Ones, is I brought cinema to the documentary medium, which Errol Morris is probably one of the only people that is known for doing that.
Yeah.
One of my favorite documentaries of all time, obviously Thin Blue Line, but Fog of War I love.
Yeah.
But he's one of the only people that, and there's others, but I have a different history than him.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, let me bring all my cinematic tools to this medium and elevate it.
And
yeah.
Yeah, and bringing it now, it makes a different impact, because
yes,
when he was bringing it, bringing cinematic elements, it was amazing. But now you watch them back, it's dated slightly,
yeah,
because
yeah.
of some of them elements. You're like,
right.
is this a documentary or a you know?
It was just unsolved mysteries.
Yeah, exactly. Particularly since the birth of spoof documentaries and things like that as well. You watch a few of them back now and you're like, is this legit? This is over dramatized.
That's right. But
that's what works now, is having that slickness of movement to draw it all through. Was it always intended to be a series, or was it a film at any point? Like, because it's a story that is so big, it only makes sense across a series.
I knew from day one it would be multiple parts, but Jimmy and Dre did not want to overstay their welcome, so they thought it was one part. Alan, it's one part. It was one part for a year and a half. It was killing me. But I always knew it was five.
Yeah.
And then my executive at HBO, who financed the film. Which is odd, it being on Netflix, I hear. Said four parts, Alan, ultimately. And they were always wonderful creatively. So that's why each one is its own time length.
Yeah.
Because if there were five, I could have even. But what I love about and what I loved about working with HBO, too, Netflix has the same thing as well. Each episode, and by the way, let me slap myself. It's not an episode. Each part.
Each part, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, making him a murderer was episodes.
Yeah,
you know, the Jinx and the HBO was episodes.
Yeah,
these were parts.
Yeah,
and in that, each one had its own DNA, like a record too.
Yeah, completely.
Back to the record DJing the things. Yeah. Like each song had to make the crowd move that way because that's the way the crowd needed to move.
Yeah,
you know, and I love that
completely. Know? And I love that. Again, I'm glad that. That HBO and Netflix have a good relationship, because we don't have HBO over here, so it's kind of nice that we're getting these things. But I also love that they're aware that TV is changing, and it's exactly that. And each part should be the length it needs to be. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have to have, to be this long, and there has to be a break here, because that's what... Like, you still see shows that are made for digital that are built with... an advert break type thing. And this is like, well, no, just tell the story how it needs to be told. Surely that's the way forward in this.
I got to tell you, too, it's, you know, I learned that in this thing, when you look at each chapter, too, whether it's about Bruce Springsteen or Eazy-E or Tom Petty or N.W.A. and then Snoop, each story has its own life.
Yeah.
Some can stay longer. Some got to go now because of the way that people are talking, the way they're moving. And I think HBO and Netflix have really innovated that whole style of, like, you know what? This is what it needs to be. And celebrated the filmmakers for doing it.
Yeah.
I call it like a play, like when rock stars play for themselves.
Yeah.
I never played for myself in this.
Yeah.
Although there were moments that I did some things that were interesting. I don't think were done before. I always kept the audience in mind.
Yeah, that's great.
And the crowd, back to the DJ thing. Like, you got to make sure everyone's moving on that dance. That's what someone was telling me about Dre. Lonzo Williams told me Dre's first, I won't call him a mentor. Lonzo owned the World Class Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
And he saw Dre's talent as a DJ, as a world class DJ. I said, well, what makes a world class DJ? He says, a world class DJ looks at the room and makes sure everyone's moving.
Yeah.
Even the guy that doesn't want to move, he makes sure that guy's tapping his foot.
Yeah.
And he said Dre knew that. Dre knew how to make everyone move.
Yeah.
And I was just learning those things and adopting him into the process of the film, you know.
And that must have been part of the excitement in making it, because you're going to have, particularly when you knew the people in the rap world but didn't necessarily know all the people in the rock world. So when you started to see these crazy similarities and parallels, you're probably getting excited as an audience member, and therefore knowing, well, this is going to excite, like, I need to show people this and show how how similar Springsteen and Dre are. Who would have thought Springsteen and Dre would be so similar? But there's a point in the last part, I think it is, where you kind of bring that kind of full circle with a reference that you're like, oh shit, this is the same. This is the same thing. This is the same vision and sight that pushed these two forward.
You're picking up on something that I've never heard anyone really clue into. It is that the number one thing for me, because of it's called the Defiant Ones.
Yeah,
it's about the black and white of it all.
Yeah,
and I'm biracial.
Yeah,
so I'm a product of both of them. Is how interconnected they are, and celebrating together both genres, both cultures,
yeah,
and the contributions that both made and how similar they are. Listen, when I was sitting down with Stevie Nicks, sitting down with Snoop and Stevie Nicks was the same thing to me. That's they amazing, spoke the same language.
Oh, what a sentence that is, right? that's fucking amazing.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, but they spoke the same language. It's the same. It gave me goosebumps. Yeah. And for me, the most exciting thing to celebrate both cultures together.
Yeah.
To put rock and hip-hop side by side. That's why the only time I brag about the Grammy I won, which I never thought I'd win a Grammy for this, was to me validating rock and hip-hop side by side.
Yeah, rather than odds or conflicting as one.
And for the Grammy for them to recognize that instead of just one, there's the documentary about hip hop, there's a documentary about rock. Yeah, it's about both, and this is about celebrating both, you know. And there were moments in this too where it was incredible to take Marilyn Manson's music and Marilyn Manson and then have Tupac wilding out to Beautiful People.
Yeah.
And seeing that that's the same thing.
That it felt like I was at a club just watching a master DJ. I was like, I want to be on my feet for this. This is going there. So, well, that's the perfect a place to end it. I know you've only got a limited amount of time, so thank you very much for chatting. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Look at the mix board. You guys don't see the mix board here.
I've got it going on, right? There we go. That was Alan Hughes. Confession here. You know the bit on there where he said about Snoop standing at a urinal trying to convince him to put him in one of his films? Legit, as soon as this podcast finished, I was like, of course, just so you know, I'm an actor as well now. I've done two TV series on FX. I've got a film with 20th Century Fox in the cinemas at the moment. Another film coming out later this year. So if you ever want to work together, as you can see from our conversation, we've got a similar outlook on film. I'm a nerd for this thing, and I've just I Snoop Dogged it. I took my Snoop Dogg moment, and I've got no shame in that. but then we quickly, in between, had a quick photo, me, him, and Jimmy, and that was great. Then I got to sit down with the legend that is Jimmy Iovine, and again, it was a whirlwind. After such a kind of calm and related conversation with Alan, I still related hugely with Jimmy, but my list of things I wanted to talk about, as you'll know, I'm a huge Springsteen fan. I'm a huge Dre fan. I'm a huge Eminem. I didn't even mention Eminem in the intro. There's a bit in the documentary where it's called The Defiant Ones. It's on Netflix, but where Dre and Eminem go into the studio together for the first time, having just met through Jimmy. And it's one of the most mind-blowing things I've ever seen. So anyway, I talk about this with Jimmy. Let's just get into that conversation. This is Jimmy Iovine on the Distraction Pieces podcast. Let's go.
It's an English podcast.
Take a seat. English podcast indeed. Distraction Pieces.
I just need a bottle of water. Here you go.
We'll grab you a water.
Is that okay, soundbox?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. Yeah, no problem. Thank you. But thank you for checking.
Did you just do Alan?
Yes. We just had a good chat.
Yeah, Alan's great, man. Alan's great.
Sling them all together. Have you spent a lot of time in the UK then? Yes, I loved it. Good. I thought it was amazing. It blew me away. Obviously, I was already aware of your work, but not aware of just the intricacy of it all.
Are you a music background or TV?
I'm music. I've been touring for years. I stopped doing music about 3 years ago, and I've started acting and doing podcasts.
Oh, great.
And it's a bit of everything. But I've started a rolling. I'm joined by a Jimmy Iovine. How's it all going? You enjoying being in the UK?
I really am. My wife, Liberty Ross, is from the UK, from London, and so I really have fun when I come here with her, and she really enjoys it. And I've been going a couple of dinner with some friends, and you know, London's a great place, man. What's not to love? You know, I didn't invent that.
Yeah, yeah. How was it being the subject of this documentary series? Because despite all you've achieved, despite the regular descriptions of you being an experience as much as anything, you do come across constantly as quite humble and kind of wanting to be in the background. I liked, again, we'll get into it a bit, but I liked the amount of people that you've produced or worked the boards for, yet you were saying in the documentary, producers just are there to facilitate and press play. It's the artists who are doing the magic.
Well, I look at my whole life like that. I'm always like ready to begin again.
Yeah.
That's exciting to me, is to like say, okay, I don't know how to do this. Let's begin again.
Yeah.
And as long as you're willing to do that and be of service, no matter what you're doing, whether it's Beats headphones or Apple Music or recording engineer or record producer or running Interscope Records or starting Interscope Records, as long as you're willing to have the energy to begin again and listen and take input and value that input and not breathe your own exhaust, I think you can do anything.
Yeah, and that's what comes across, is that ability to add, to have your clarity of vision and add that to what other people are bringing in.
That's
and other
right.
people are saying, rather than try and shout over anyone or falsehood your view, just say, look, I see what you're saying, but also
that's exactly right.
This might help.
That's exactly right. And if you work with great people, if you cast who you work with great
yeah.
enough, you don't mind losing an argument.
Yeah.
You know, like, for Completely. Example, I mean, I'm not comparing myself to them, but Paul and John.
Yeah.
Whoever won the argument, it was going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you get into business with people, like, you don't mind losing it, like with Dr. Dre. If I lose an argument to Dr. Dre, I know I'm going to be okay. What he's going to do is not crap.
Yeah.
We may lose, but it's not crap.
I love that. It's covering your back.
And that's what it's about. It's about being in the business with the right – cast your life correctly, whether it's your marriage, your partner, your friends. Just cast your life great.
Yeah. And so I was trying to
– And one other thing. My father taught me.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a trick.
Yeah.
And that is when the cat is bigger than the shit,
yeah,
you keep the cat. The minute the shit gets bigger than the cat, you got to think about keeping the cat.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay?
I love that.
That helps.
That's beautiful. I was looking through, as someone who grew up listening to rock and punk, and then I was pretty in love with hip-hop, and the music I made for my career was hip-hop, I was trying to find the link between the people you've worked with and teamed up with, from Springsteen to Patti Smith to Dre to Snoop, all these other people.
All the things that I'm attracted to are things that are trying to push the boundaries.
Yeah.
Anarchy, push the buttons, social consciousness, talking about the culture, about society, whether it's Dre and Snoop reflecting what it was like in the inner city, or, you know, or Tupac or Trent Reznor. You know, I find that, I'll be frank with you, right now I'm finding that a lot more in actual paintings and drawings, because
right.
like artists like Mark Bradford or, you know, Ligon or Ed Ruscha just did a painting of a tattered American flag that is so powerful. So, and I'm not finding a lot of that in music. Like, I find Kendrick Lamar, I'm like, okay, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, and, but I'm not finding a lot of lyrics and music that are doing, that are trying to make a difference. Because music does make a difference. And if you get the right lyrical power around the right, in the right person with the right songs, you can move things. And so right now I'm finding it mostly in art, which is kind of weird, but, that's just the truth.
It's interesting. It's finding that motivation and drive in any form. And it struck me from watching the documentary that your upbringing in Hell's Kitchen, in kind of coming from that working class background, allowed you to connect. It's one of the connections I could see from Springsteen to Dre to all these other people.
Yeah.
People who are making a music, not because it's a hobby, because they've got something on the side. They're making it against all odds.
It's very
they
simple.
Have to make it. It's got
it's
an urgency.
Simple. they're looking for great, not success.
Yeah.
There they want success, but what they're really looking for is great. Yeah. You know, Bruce said it best. He said, I didn't want to be rich. I didn't want to be famous. I didn't even want to be happy. I wanted to be great.
Yeah.
And as long as you're going for great and not buying your own bullshit, you got a chance of going for a very long career and keeping focused. I mean, Springsteen right now, he's on Broadway doing some of the best work he's ever done in his yeah. life in that one-man show. It's incredible. And to think that at 68 years old, he's created something, a completely new a vehicle for himself. I watched the show twice. It's awesome. You know, and Dre did Compton, and then he did, you know, now he's doing this TV show. And it's just, if you stay with the great,
yeah,
and not get caught up in the success and the fame, you could always do things that are great.
Yeah, and do you think your ability or the ability in general to learn on the job is key, rather than sit back and think, I can't do that, how do I do that? Kind of just jumping in, and early on in the show, it shows the example of Easter Sunday 1973, where you went into work when most people wouldn't, to work the boards, didn't know who you were
I went to answer the phones.
Oh, you went to answer the phones?
They asked me, I want you to answer the phones today. And I said, yeah, but they were messing with me, John Lennon and Roy Sakala.
Yeah.
Said, we wanted you to join our session. We just wanted to see if you would come in on Sunday from your mother's house.
Yeah.
They were funny guys. So I said, of course I'll come in. I'm not blowing this. I'm not going to blow an opportunity. I just wanted to be near it.
Yeah.
I felt if I could be near it and be of service, that something good would happen.
Yeah.
And that was my intention completely. John Landau from Bruce Springsteen's team, and was a producer on Born to Run, taught me the hard way that it wasn't about me.
Yeah.
The project is not about you. It's about the project.
Yeah.
And leave your bullshit where it belongs.
Yeah.
And being able to pivot and be able to take fear and have it push you from behind rather than stand in front of you. We're all fear. I get fear every day. Everyone gets fear. Oh my God, this might not work, or this is, someone's going to look at me in a funny way. First of all, no one cares. They're watching themselves, especially today.
100%.
You know, and it's just about taking that fear and having it push you forward and not to be intimidated by it.
Yeah. Yes. So how was it? For example, like you mentioned, a Born to Run there. It was evident in the show that one of the things that got you through that was your, you know, determination to just stick it out, to work these long hours, to not go home, to keep pushing through. And that's easy with hindsight, because you're working on fucking Born to Run, of course it's. But at the time, That's it. At the time, you're just working on a record. So it's having that drive and dedication. It's easy for people to look back now and go, well, I'd do that. But
I was of service. I wanted to deliver for John, the band, Bruce. I wanted to deliver for those people. I didn't want to be the one to let them down. And I wanted to learn. And I stayed after those sessions, even if I worked 15 hours, and just to try to learn more about what I was doing for the next day.
Yeah.
I did not want to be the person in that room that stopped the train.
Yeah. 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 That fear of not earning your worth, knowing that you can be doing everything you can to not be the weak link.
Yeah. And that's push it. Through. That's it. And that's fear. But when I took that fear, I said, okay, I'm afraid of that, but I'm more afraid of being the weak link.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know what I mean? So screw it. I'm going to go figure this out. You know, I didn't always figure it out, but I did sometimes.
So how was it from that? And I promise I'm not going to go through every point in the documentary. Cool, We've only got half an hour. But how was it to go from that to taking the lead with someone like Patti Smith, who was just iconic and legendary? And
well, I those 5 years, 73 to 78, were my college years.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky. I did 3 albums with John Lennon. I did 2 albums with Bruce Springsteen, and I did 1 album with Patti Smith. And Patti Smith asked me to produce her record because she saw me working with Bruce and saw my hustle. That was exactly what she says in the documentary. You know, so, but when I worked with her, I had a little bit of confidence, and I started to learn, like, okay, we could do something different. And I was the producer. I wasn't the engineer anymore, so I had to contribute to the actual structure of the record and more than the sound. And that was a really exciting experience. And Patty believed in me. Like, I was so honored that Patty believed in me that I wasn't going to fail her. There was no chance. None. Zero. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I don't care. I could take more pain than you, period. End of story.
Yeah. That's amazing.
That's how I felt. I don't know if it's true, but that's what I felt.
How was it when you got Patty, because the night from Bruce Springsteen, because Easter as an album is a jarring and urgent and far from commercial type record, but then you got this single, and that's what everyone wants, particularly that time, the big single that leads the album. But this was a big single that was leading them to, you know, an album that felt dangerous and threatening and
royal.
Well,
to me it was, because the woman singing those lyrics, desire is hunger, the fire I breathe, love is a banquet on which we feed, because a woman singing, because the night belongs to lovers, take me now, baby, here as I am, hold me close, try to understand. Those lyrics were so, and because the night belongs to lovers was so powerful that I felt it fit with the record. I felt the woman doing those lyrics in those days, you know, it was almost like, you know, the Shangri-Las or something, you know, like where it was just like, oh, wow, this is going to be really exciting. And I knew, yes, we needed an introduction to the album in those days. You know what I mean? You couldn't come out with, 25th Floor first, you know. And so I just said, Patty, I think you should do this, man. I think this – it reminded me of It's My Life by the Animals.
Right, yeah.
It didn't sound like it, but in my head, something always reminds me of something else. So it reminded me of It's My Life. I said, wow, Patty doing a song like this, sounding like the Animals, doing It's My Life, is going to fly. Yeah. I just know it is.
And again, it added something huge. I think, yeah, completely right, that a female singing those – our vocals made all the difference. It makes me think of when Cyndi Lauper did When You Were Mine, which as a Prince song probably would have been an average Prince song.
Right.
Cyndi Lauper singing it's amazing.
Same thing
and
with
iconic.
Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah, exactly that. That these songs that could have been
lost. I did it with Tom Petty later with Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
We just stopped dragging my heart around.
Yeah.
You know, they want to make a meal of some bright-eyed kid. You need someone to look after you. At that time, that was not the thinking. You know what I mean? It was like, and I just said, oh, man, if she sings these lyrics, they're going to be incredible. Because I know Stevie is that strong and powerful as a person. I said, if she sings these lyrics, she would never write them. But if she sings them, we're going to win.
Yeah, I love that. So how was it to go to be at that point a decorated and praised producer and technician to then go, right, I'm starting a label instead. I'm stopping that. I'm done with that.
I was 36, 37 years old, and I wasn't working with my peers anymore. I was working with people much younger than me. And the people that were much younger than me, they were looking for, I don't know. I mean, I could work with some of them, but the record companies were trying to keep me away, or whatever. I was too expensive, or whatever nonsense that is. The record companies wanted the control. They felt if I was in the room, they didn't have control.
Yeah.
They were right. But I just said, then my friend David Geffen, who taught me business in my life, I had no feel for business, you know, none, zero. And Geffen went on a 20-year campaign of teaching me about business, you know? And so when I saw that he started his record company and sold his record company, I said, wow, what if I could have a record company? And then I were able to work with producers, and I'll produce them, and they'll produce the young artists that I don't really understand, like hip-hop.
Yeah.
I would have never known how to produce a hip-hop record.
Yeah.
No chance. But Dr. Dre knew how to produce a hip-hop record, and I could still be involved somewhat because I was the label, and I could help Dre.
Yeah.
And that's how I look at my life. And it was also a pivot. I don't want to do the same thing for 40 years. I would have killed myself.
Yeah.
Some people can. I can't.
Yeah. It seemed to be as well. The thing that struck me is your ability to, number one, find talent, but almost as importantly, find talent who can find a talent. And that's evident with Dre, with finding Snoop and Eminem and things like that, but also with Trent Reznor bringing Marilyn Manson through.
Yeah.
So it felt like rather than... You weren't just starting a label and signing artists. You were signing the heads of families as yeah, such. I'm going to sign Dre, because Dre's going to bring the rest.
If you have artists like that, you have a relationship with them, what they find is great. They're looking for great. Yeah. They're not looking for gimmicks. They're not looking to say, gee, you know, well, this would be a hit if we, you know, put this pop singer on. They're looking for great.
Yeah.
And when you have people out there looking for great that are great, sometimes they miss some stuff. But, like, you know, Dre, the minute Paul Rosenberg played Dre, Kendrick Lamar, Dre was, I'm in.
Yeah.
You know, now he's got Anderson .Paak.
Yeah.
And the kid, I saw it last night. He's unbelievable. You know, Dre is far and few in between, but he commits to very little.
Yeah.
And it's all about being great, man. You want great. You want great stuff. You want to be in the room with great people. And the only way you get in the room with great people is by being of service. Unless you're the singer yourself. I'm not a painter and I'm not a singer. So I've got to help in some other way.
And how rewarding is it watching when that works, though? One of the highlights of the documentary for me was you kind of playing Dre, Eminem, and then seeing them gel so amazingly in their first ever session together, essentially writing My Name Is. So how's that for you? Because no matter how well you've done, there's going to be that nervous, particularly as someone who didn't come from hip-hop, to go to Dre, here's this white boy from Detroit. I think you'll like him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then it being, all right, there must have been some nerves and trepidation.
Well, because I'm willing to be wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I come at it from a way of like, Dre, look, you know, I think this could be clever. You know, it could be interesting. You know what I mean? If you don't like it, throw it in the ocean. I'm not afraid to fail. I'm not afraid that Dre say, shut up, this is the dumbest thing you've ever thought of. I don't care. You know what I mean? And I'll try something else the next day. Because I don't let that I don't care.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I really don't. And I'll try something and experiment with it. And I've got a feel for people. I just, when I heard what, I knew that Eminem was anarchy and Dre was anarchy. Whether they could work together, I have no idea. But I know they both represent the same thing.
Yeah.
And I said, they both represent the same thing, then maybe this could work.
Yeah, yeah. And it's finding those things that others might not see, right? I grew up listening to punk, and so I loved No Doubt. And when you put her with Pharrell on paper, I was like, I don't know how that works. This is No Doubt. This is Scar. And then Gwen Stefani just did all this amazing, her work with Pharrell became
a completely next level. And with Dre and Eve.
Yeah, 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 and completely. And blow your mind, yeah.
But see, I had an idea for Gwen. I knew Gwen. I knew the whole other side to Gwen.
Yeah.
So when she wanted to do a solo record, and she asked me to help her with it, I was involved more in A&R on that record than I am in most records at Interscope.
Yeah.
And I just said, let's experiment, right? Let's get you into urban culture. Let's get you on the dance floor, right? Let's do that, right? And we had to find the right way to do it. And, you know, Pharrell did a great record with her, and so did Dre.
Yeah.
Akon did a great record with her, and... we just kept moving it around and experimenting, and she was very game and very open about it. And she's a fabulous person, artist. I mean, she's everything.
It feels to me that the Gwen Stefani album really paved the way and opened the doors for everyone to accept the whirlwind of Lady Gaga a few years down the line, because it was that combination of craziness of saying, look, I don't care what genre, I don't care anything else, this is, and you know, being
what's funny about life, and this is very helpful to people sometimes when I talk to people, and some people get it from the movie, is that no matter how far along you go, no matter how successful you are, no matter what you have, no matter what credits or bullshit you have, you will always do something and somebody will say it can't work. When we signed Lady Gaga, she walked in my office, this guy Vince brought her in, and I don't even know if she played me music. She started telling me a story about dance music and Andy Warhol and the East Village and the 70s. I mean, she was 22 years old. And I said, wow, this girl's really, really interesting. And I signed her.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe she played me a song. Then my radio team said to me, we can't get Four on the Floor records on the radio in America.
Right.
That's for Europe and that's for, you know, a few dance stations.
Yeah.
I said, that's ridiculous. I just came back from Europe with Timbaland, and they were playing some Four on the Floor records, and it's pop music. It just is. There will be pop music in America. So I pushed my radio people really, really hard. And Gaga, I mean, it's not, there were other four floor records, but she really helped blend those two things together and commercializing it. And Gwen, what we did at that time was, I wasn't really happy with where hip hop was.
Right.
So I had all these hip hop producers. And by coincidence, I had all these female singers. So we had Fergie, Gwen, the Pussycat Dolls. We had Nelly Furtado. You know, so we had all these great singers. And we had all these producers. So I said, why don't we just put them together?
Yeah.
And we put those producers together, like Timbaland with Nelly. That really worked. Pharrell with Gwen. That really worked. And, you know, and Fergie and, you know, Will.i.am and Polo de Don, a few other producers. And we really struck oil. It just really, all those records were out at the same time.
Yeah. Just speaking of things being out at the same time. I'm going to rewind a little bit. The two of the biggest points of backlash against music, I guess, were the gangster rap explosion and the fear in America of Marilyn Manson. They were both with you and very much in your wheelhouse. How was that at the time to be dealing with the protests against Marilyn Manson, the anger there, then the protests against gangster rap.
I've seen it my whole life, you know, whether it be Elvis Presley or the Beatles or whatever it is. You know, you see people against music. I mean, Berry Gordy, what a great record man he was. Not only was he a great record man, but he had to get his music on the radio where they didn't play black people, let alone black music.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if that guy could do that, why aren't I? This is all nonsense. Yeah. What, to me, when I hear this stuff about, well, this is affecting this in your culture, I just say, you know, this is time to do what Patti Smith said. You know, the power to lead, the power to rule, the power to wrestle the world from fools. Because that's what all this is. And people complaining about lyrics and all this nonsense. I knew it was a poltergeist. I knew that if you walk through it, you come out on the other side and everybody would be fine. People tortured about Tupac. Yeah. And then when he died, they eulogized him. Yeah. Same night.
Yeah, yeah.
ABC News, they crushed him 6 weeks before. The night he died, he's Pope Tupac.
A hero, yeah.
So I've seen that so many times that I know to ignore what I ignore the noise, you know? Just say, you know, I'm going forward. I believe in this. The thing with Death Row, you know, it was a very tough situation in a lot of ways, but I wasn't going to back away from that either. I refused to.
So how was it after getting through all of that, after, again, a lot of labels would have folded or crumbled, getting through all that, and then being hit with the death of the CD and the death of the album and the death of people paying for music, and once again having to adjust and go, right,
well, how do we live in this world? Again, that's pivoting, and I said, okay. Once I saw Napster and met Sean Fanning, I was like, okay. And it's coming again, by the way.
Yeah.
And I said, we're toast. I said, but what we can do is be of service to our artists, not just take people's rights. Become partners with them in other businesses.
Yeah.
So we can take music and expand that, do something great for them, and it's great for us as well.
Yeah.
So I tried a few things, and then I hooked up with Dre, and we decided to do headphones and speakers.
I loved his quote of fuck sneakers, we're going to make speakers. Or well, we need to make speakers.
That's because it's always on my mind doing this combination of things, right? So when he said that, I said, whoa, this is about audio. No one cares what kind of sneakers Dre wears. No one, not a person on the earth.
Yeah.
But they will care about audio. And then, you know, from getting the idea to executing it is like, you know, a lot of work and a big headache and a lot of fear and a lot of pressure and a lot of noise, a lot of failure. But, you know, if you can get excited about an idea and you really believe in it, just keep going. Keep pushing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll wrap things up now as we're towards at the end of our time. But you said about leading people in different ventures into different areas in business. That's all well and good, but then some people are still who they are. So how was it when you've led Dre and you've got this huge deal that no one's allowed to know about, that's this big secret, Beats has sold for $3 billion,
right?
And you've not told, you've had close friends and family asking, you've said, I can't say anything yet,
right?
And then a Facebook a video goes up, and Tyrese and Dre have had a few drinks, maybe.
Yeah,
referring to him as the first a billionaire in hip hop, and well, it kind of blew
was,
the deal.
What happened was, I called Dre that morning. I said, Dre, because I know Dre relates to movies. I said, Dre, Goodfellas, Jimmy, character Jimmy, looks at his guys and say, "Don't flash this weekend. We're hot. Don't buy anything. Don't buy a Cadillac. Don't buy furs.
Fur coats."
So I told him that, and I said, "Dre, it leaked last night. We can't be the people verifying this." He says, "I got you." Well, him going to the studio is not a risk to him. So he's not thinking about Facebook and any crap like that. So he's having some fun with his friends. But then all shit hit the fan, you know. And Will says it in the movie. I just said, you know what? We rode in here together. We're riding out together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the horse I rode in on. So, you know, we just rode it. And people at Apple were as great as I thought they would be. And they got it. And they supported us. And now it's really successful, so I'm really happy about it. But I gotta be honest with you, it rocked me. It really did. Because I worked for a very long time on that, and it rocked me.
But again, I mean, with hindsight, it turned out to be the best marketing tool ever, because that was then all anyone was talking about, and the whispers. If you'd simply announced it,
it
would have been on the business pages.
Here's the deal.
When you're
near Apple, everything is the most thing talked about.
Yeah,
you know, we took a long while to get comfortable with that ourselves. Apple is just, everyone wants to write about anything Apple, and they want the word Apple in there so they get clicks and all this nonsense in the headlines. So we had to learn how to be a little more careful. You know, we were a little more sort of free spirit in our old lives, but at Apple, we got to be a little bit more careful, justifiably so. They have a very big business, and they take it very serious. But we want to be able to bring popular culture there and help them out, and they already have it, but things that we can add. And they've been great. They've been fantastic, a great company.
Yeah. Well, I'll end it there, and thank you very much for your time. Man. I look forward to seeing what the next pivot is going to be and what the next move is going to be.
Yeah, well.
What do you see as ahead for yourself?
Peace.
Just some peace.
Peace.
Some peace.
Peace is the holy grail, man.
That's perfect.
Peace is the holy grail, man. You can work with people. Whatever you can do with peace, as long as it fits in with peace. At my age, 65 years old, that's what I'm looking for. If somebody comes up with an idea and I challenge it and I chase it, I'm going to help Apple with the streaming service, you know, because I want to complete that thought. But as far as, you know, myself, it's about peace.
Beautiful. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, man. Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. How was that for an episode? Hot damn. Hugely grateful for getting the time with these guys. Really good chat. I really enjoyed it. I felt, excited to talk to both of them. And again, I know I'm plugging it like crazy, but I'm allowed to. It's my podcast and I rated it. I recommend Defiant Ones on Netflix. It's available now and it's fantastic. It's a little, it's not, what was it Alan Hughes was saying? It's not a series. It's not episodes, it's parts. But yeah, it's fantastic and it'll blow you away. Seeing a lot of these moments, Jimmy in with Springsteen and things like that, or even Dre, some footage and stories of some of Dre's first ever DJ sets and how he was doing stuff that no other DJ had done before, and the reactions, all the way up to Jimmy getting a tape out by a guy called Slim Shady and playing it to Dre, and Dre and M meeting, and yeah, it's real good, man. You're going to like it. That's all I've got for you this week. I'll be back next week. I'm looking at my phone now to see who I've got on next week. I have got a lot of podcasts recorded, and they're some of the best podcasts I've ever done. I rate this one up there with one of the best. Oh, next week is literally as good as any I've ever done. I've got a young lady on called Alexis Okowo, and she's a journalist who wrote an amazing book called A Moonless Starless Sky. And it's about regular people in Africa fighting extremism and their stories that aren't told.
And it blew me away. Honestly, that sounds heavy, but it's a really engaging conversation. The thing that blew me away was hearing that it's fighting Muslim extremism and Christian extremism. We kind of, in the UK, only seem to hear about, you know, Islamic extremism, but there's extremism of numerous religions going on now all around the world. Again, when we talk of, when people argue against Islam being dangerous and argue, well, Christianity, we generally refer to the Crusades and stuff like that, but it was amazing to read about the stuff that's going on right now in the name of Christianity. It's an amazing conversation. She's put herself at a lot of risk. It was a similar feeling to when I got to sit down with Suad McKennitt last year. Just a real honour to sit down with someone who's, in the name of journalism, in the name of telling stories, of giving voices to the voiceless, puts themselves at huge risk in dangerous situations with dangerous people. And then the thing I loved about the way Alexis writes is the warmth, and it becomes these really personal and relatable stories. They're so insane situations, yet somehow they feel so relatable. So, yeah, honestly, you're going to really enjoy next week's. I'm really excited about it. So, and then after that, I've got Charlotte Hatherley. That's recorded. Which ones have I got recorded? I don't mention the ones I haven't got recorded, but I've got some good ones lined up as well. I've got Cedric Bixler-Zavala about The Driving. That's going to be in about 3 weeks. I've got Jamali Maddox. That's going to be in about 4 weeks. He's got a great documentary series on Vice at the moment called Hate Thy Neighbour that you can watch online for free. Just loads of good stuff to come. I'm packing them in and packing them out. Thank you for tuning in. We're on social media as the Distraction Pieces Network. So come find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Appreciate your support if you do that. And share, spread the word. You see, these rambling, unplanned, and nonsensical outros are why I'll never get to sell the Distraction Pieces Network for $3.2 billion. Although, hit me up, Jimmy, if you want to do some business. See you all next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.